welcome to Faith in Politics. I'm Meg.
And I'm Rodney.
Hi guys, thanks for joining us for another episode of Faith in Politics. Today we have an interview with the amazing Lord Alf Dubs, a Labour peer and former MP, who first came to the UK as a child on the Kinder transport during the Second World War and has dedicated his time in the House of Lords to campaigning for refugees, including the famous Dubs Amendment. He shares with us what brings him hope in the fight for refugee rights and sets the record as the first ever humanist interviewee on the podcast. What else have we got on today, Rodney?
Before that, we have a little feature from Steve Hucklesby on the TPNW, which was ratified last week. He speaks about the significance and what the UK government can be doing.
And in what I guess you could call a Steve sandwich, we finish up with another feature from the brilliant Steve Tinning, who shares a prayer with us, exploring how we can be praying for refugees and our role as Christians in responding to the crisis.
Let's get into the interview then.
Let's get into it then. So, listeners might remember that the brilliant Lucy featured on the podcast last year talking to us about the TPNW, and last week was a significant milestone in the development of that. So, this year we have the also brilliant Steve on to tell us a little bit more about it. So, Steve, could you just remind us what the TPNW is?
Yes, certainly. The TPNW is a new treaty that has now banned nuclear weapons under international law. So, states signing and ratifying the treaty agree not to produce, develop, stockpile, or possess nuclear weapons. That's the key core element of the treaty. So it entered into force on Friday. After 51 states have now ratified the treaty, 86 states have signed the treaty.
So what was the significance of ratification?
In a nutshell, nuclear weapons, the possession of is now illegitimate under international law. So the significance of this is that it strengthens the international norm against the possession and use of nuclear weapons. Its international norms, first of all, pertain to states, but they also have a wider influence in the world. They have an influence on civil society. So the treaty has come about in part through a mass movement of civil society under ICAN.
Fab. So what's the UK's part in all of this?
The UK government is very concerned about this treaty, doesn't endorse the treaty. I think possibly it is concerned about this development of a new international norm. It also makes the case that we can't deal with the dangers of nuclear weapons and their use purely by passing something in law that says they are banned. The argument the UK government is stating is that they say we are in favour of disarmament, we are working towards that, but in order to be able to achieve disarmament, we must first deal with the underlying security and insecurity conditions that cause people to want to have nuclear weapons in the first place. The counter-argument is that nuclear weapons also cause tensions and distrust between states, and proponents of the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons might use the phrase that there are no safe hands for bad weapons.
What's the theological basis for the Church's position in regards to nuclear weapons?
Firstly, this relates to the horror of a nuclear weapon, the idea that with the touch of a button, you can destroy so many lives, hundreds of thousands of lives, and devastate the environment and God's creation. It seems that nuclear weapons, to me, deny the dignity of human life, that dignity of every human individual, which is intrinsically part of God's creation and his relationship with us. But there is also, within the Christian tradition, a rich tradition around just war. Here it's a little bit contentious, but I would suggest that most people, when you are looking at weapons from a just war perspective, would probably conclude that there could be no justice in the use of a weapons that are so indiscriminate. Now, if that is the case, then it is also quite reasonable to make the case that if the use of nuclear weapons is inadmissible, then the threat of use of nuclear weapons, which is an essential part of nuclear deterrence, is also just as inadmissible.
Brilliant. Thanks so much, Steve. And is there anything, if people are listening, that they could go and look at to find out more about this, or if they felt like they wanted to take action on it?
Yes, there is. There's a really easy and simple task I think that we can all do on this, and that's related to our bank accounts and our pensions. With the advent of the entry into force of the TPNW, now is the time for banks and pension companies to be ensuring that our money is not invested in nuclear weapons. We have a very simple action that you can take to send a letter off to your bank or pension funds. If your bank or pension fund is one of 15 listed in our survey, then you can send that letter off with the click of the button. Have a look at our report, have a look at that action, and you'll find it on the website www.investinginchange.uk.
So thanks so much for being with us today, Lord Dubs. Could you just tell us really quickly a bit about your story and how you came to be a Labour Lord in the House of Lords in the UK?
Oh, that's quite a tall, order. I was born in Prague. My father was Jewish, my mother wasn't. And to cut a long story short, my father escaped when the Nazis occupied Prague, Czechoslovakia in March 1939. My mother was refused permission to leave, and she put me on a kinder transport, and I arrived in London. And eventually my mother, having been refused permission to leave, did manage to escape. So we got to the UK, but then my father died a few months later. And my mum, well, we lived in all sorts of places, but eventually she sent me to a school, a boarding school run by the Czech government in exile for Czech refugee children, which I went to for several years. And then the war ended, and my mum went back to Prague and had a look, but everybody we knew had either died in the camps or had left the country. So there was nowhere to live, there was nothing for her. So she decided, she had a job now, so she decided to stay in the UK. So I got passionately interested in politics. When I was about 14 or so, 13, because I was trying to understand why what had happened to me had happened. Anyway, so we went to, I started interested in politics, and so eventually I went to LSE, my ambition then was to become a local councillor, because I thought with my background, you know, I'm an immigrant and all this sort of stuff, what can I do? You don't understand this sort of sentiment. Anyway, and I thought, what can I do? And so I thought maybe I could hang it on local council. Anyway, a friend of mine who was an MP said to me, "Look, have a go at Parliament." Well, I got on to the local council, and eventually I got into Parliament for two terms in Battersea.
When you were choosing to stand as an MP, how conscious were you of the fact that you were a refugee and how that would relate to the British people, and how was it something you were able to overcome?
Well, I never made much of it. My background really only got public when I started campaigning on behalf of child refugees a few years ago. But in the Commons, no, I didn't hide it, but I didn't make anything of it. You know, I sort of, it's just one of the things my local Labour Party people, some of them knew about it because, you know, it came up in conversation.
So you kind of just said that part of the reason you got into politics was to try and understand why what happened to you happened. How do you think, when you did get into politics, your experiences as a child impacted the priorities you kind of chose to undertake and the way you did politics?
I think it influenced me in the sense that I felt there were minorities and that the underdog had to be backed up and supported politically, and the discrimination against minorities was absolutely appalling, and that was my sort of keynote, my key theme to myself all along, whatever sort of discrimination there was that I would come across, became something that I had to be on the alert to and do something about. So I was chair of a thing called the Local Community Relations Council. This was in Paddington, next to North Kensington. I got to know all about the politics of North Kensington. I got in the Commons, and I was interested all the time. I got myself on the Home Affairs Committee, and then my second term, Neil Kinnock put me on the front bench to deal with race relations and immigration policy, and so on. So all of that sort of mattered, was important. But in the answer to the other question you asked about how did I feel being a refugee in the Commons, because there weren't many minorities in the Commons in those days. And I remember the first time I was down to ask Margaret Thatcher a question, I stood up and I said to myself, gosh, can this be me standing up in the House of Commons asking the British Prime Minister a question? How can this be me? And I nearly forgot my question. So there was all that. But on the other hand, people were pretty tolerant. I mean, if people were against me, they didn't say so. So then I lost my seat, and I became head of the Refugee Council. I was able to do all those sort of things again. And then I was put in the Lords. I got involved. I was always involved with refugees, but I got involved particularly in this way. Now, we learned from Save the Children that there were 95,000 unaccompanied child refugees somewhere in Europe. And they were mostly in Greece, northern France, and Italy. And about 10,000 had disappeared. And I found this terribly shocking, that the children adrift in Europe and 10,000 disappeared. If one child disappears in this country, we all go searching and looking, and it's a desperately awful situation for the parents and so on, or everybody. And here were 10,000 children just disappeared. So anyway, I put down an amendment, because the immigration bill was going through, I talked to colleagues in the Commons. I put an amendment about taking some of the child refugees. I went to a place called Zaatari in Jordan, where there were 70,000-80,000 refugees. What I learned in Zaatari was there was a young Syrian man, and he just finished his education in the school. It was a good camp in the sense of physically there was water and sanitation, not like the jungle in Cali or even Moya, where there were these terrible places. But and I said, "What now?" He said, "Well, I've finished my education. I've tried to get a job in the camp. I can't. I've tried to get a job outside the camp. I can't. What hope do I have?" And I thought, it's this lack of hope. And I've often tried to speak about it and say that people can put up with very bad physical conditions if there's some hope for them. They can struggle on. I've never had such bad conditions as in some of those camps. But it's a hope. And I think one of the messages I say is we have got to give people hope. We can't leave our fellow human beings without any hope. And I think that's been something that I've tried to get over. And the other two things were that I've always tried to get public opinion on our side. Now, isn't always. I get nasty things occasionally, not as many as women in politics, but I get a few nasty ones. Things like pity you survived the Holocaust and stuff like that. But and the other thing, the positive thing I've taken out of all this, well, among many, is the wonderful volunteers that I've met working in the camps. There are some fantastic young people who go, they've worked in the jungle in Cali, and now they're supporting refugees who are sleeping under the trees. There are refugees helping in the camps in Greece and so on. And these are young people, many, but not exclusively from the UK, who've given up a year or two of their lives for virtually no money in order to help their fellow human beings. And I find that both humbling and awe-inspiring that young people do such great things in the most difficult physical conditions, in the camps.
Amazing, thank you. On a slightly different note, you mentioned beforehand that you're a humanist, and your father was Jewish.
He was secular though. He wasn't, there was no religion at home.
Yeah. You've been a very active humanist in Parliament. You're the treasurer of the APPG and have been very active. And you just mentioned hope being an important part. Why did you, or what kind of led you to the decision to be such an active humanist, especially in Parliament? And do you think
that that has influenced the way that since leaving Parliament you've kind of undertaken your work?
Well, I think that's quite a difficult question. Oh dear. I mean, I thought it dishonest not to be a humanist if that's what I believed in. Okay, and I found particularly. I mean, look, I go and talk to lots of faith groups. I talk to lots of Jewish groups and other faith groups, and I found faith groups incredibly supportive of the cause of refugees. And most of them don't mind I'm a humanist, especially Jewish ones who don't mind at all I'm a humanist. But I was at a I'll give you a little anecdote before I try and answer your question more seriously. During the last election, I was asked to go up to Yorkshire to support. It was to support Labour candidate in the constituency where Joe Cox had died. It's quite a anyway. They arranged a meeting for me with faith groups and schools and so on. And I was introduced as the MP was Tracy Brabin, and she introduced me as a humanist. And there was Anglican vicar, a woman, you know, sitting there, and we were chatting afterwards. And I said, I suppose you don't approve of me being a humanist. And she said, not at all, not at all. You and I believe in the same thing. It's just that I believe in God as well. Which I thought was interesting. It is an attempt to answer your question. If you want my personal, look, a lot of the things I believe about Christianity, I accept as being the right way to go forward. Not to keen on the Old Testament, but on the New Testament. I don't believe all of it, but quite a lot of it. I find it's a good basis to live by. Some people who really just treat me that don't like the idea that I'm a humanist, because I've been told by British people, that you can't actually treat other human beings as Christ said one should treat one's fellow human beings if one doesn't believe in Christ himself as being the Son of God, because you can't do it without that. Well, I think you can. I'm quite prepared to accept most of the Christian teaching in the way I should relate to my fellow human beings as being the basis for going ahead. It's not a hostility. It's not a sort of a militant anti what Rodney and what you and Rodney believe in. It's just the way I've reacted to circumstances and tried to adjust my life and do the right things.
I think that's perfectly fine. I think what I would like to know, reading through your history, it seems like community is a central belief to the way you operate in politics. Can you speak to us more about that?
Well, it's one thing to believe it. It's another thing to explain it clearly to other people. Look, I think we are individuals. We're not solitary individuals. I think we're individuals who work with our fellow human beings. And I think cooperating with one's fellow human beings and feeling part of a community at the most local level, not just at the national level, but the local level, is what gives us a lot of sustenance and substance. And therefore, I like to work with other people on things that I believe in. And I think it works better that way. And one has groups of people, whether it's a group in politics or a group elsewhere, I think it's a useful way of going forward. The trouble is politics takes so much time now that it doesn't leave time for building up other groups. But I think when I was an MP, a lot of things locally mattered to me, you know, local things. Things based on a local community centre or local community groups, all these things matter because that's where local people got their support. They didn't feel they lived in Battersea. Quite a few of them didn't even feel they lived in Battersea. They just felt the locality was particularly important to them, and that's how they got their sustenance. And sometimes it's around a church, and sometimes it's around a community center, or whatever it is. And this is what matters to people. I tell you a terrible story when people get isolated. When I was a local councillor, I was in Paddington. I was knocking on some doors, and it was a basement flat. I just, you know, doing a bit of canvassing. It wasn't an election, but just knocking on the door. And in my ward, it was Paddington. I went in, and they wanted some help with, I think it was a landlord, some problem with their rent, and they said, look, could you help me? And they said, they hadn't got any light on. It was early evening, you know, it was winter. And I said, we're trying to find some light. They said, well, sorry, I haven't got very much light here. I said, why not? Well, I said, the light doesn't work. The light's gone, the bulb's gone. I said, for heaven's sake, have you got a bulb? Yeah. They said, we can't climb up there. So I climbed there, and they'd spent months without any light in the kitchen. And I said, why didn't you ask somebody? Look, I'm happy, you know, just because I happened to chance along. And I felt so sorry for them because they were isolated. And that was the antithesis of community. You know, it took me a minute. I climbed on the chair, climbed on the table, put the newspaper down on the kitchen table and changed the bulb. And, you know, pretty easy, you know. And I thought, how awful that they felt so isolated. They couldn't ask anybody to do anything for them. And so it made me think, you know, community is important. It's important people don't feel isolated and lonely. And these are all things that matter in our, and they matter even more with the pandemic because there's a lot of lonely people about.
Definitely, thank you. And so previously you mentioned your amendments to the Immigration Bill and your work in Parliament. And I'd followed all of that closely when it was going through the House. How do you feel now about the kind of future of the British role in supporting refugees with kind of the recent developments? Is it something that you feel positive about, or is it something that doesn't give you much hope?
Well, I wouldn't, if I didn't have hope, if I didn't have hope, I couldn't go on doing it. You've got to believe in things. And you've got to believe that there's a possibility of a decent outcome. Now, look, if you look at Europe, look, Angela Merkel took a million Syrians. You know, tremendous. Now, she suffered politically for it, which was a tragedy. But I've felt that Europe as a whole should have an agreed refugee policy. We're not anywhere near that, particularly as we're not in the EU now, so we can't even influence EU thinking so much. But I think we need, as a continent, and it isn't just Europe, of course. I visited the Rohingyas in Bangladesh. You know, terrible, but because they're not easily seen on television, we don't even know anything about them at all. Desperately awful circumstances for the people there. Terrible things they've gone through. And I went some years ago. It's got worse, I think, in more recent years. So I believe as a country we can do. I think all countries should share responsibility for refugees. This is not to. I separate immigration and refugees. Immigration, we've got to have a policy and decide. You know, as a country, and that's a political argument. I'm more liberal than the government, of course. But as far as refugees are concerned, we're talking about people who fled from war, persecution, torture, terrible things happening. You know, I've talked to a Syrian boy whose father had been killed in front of him by a bomb in Aleppo or Damascus. How can anybody, the rest of his life would be scarred by this dreadful experience? But they've all had, many of the refugees have had dreadful experiences. And I think we have to be more supportive and more welcoming. And I think we have to pull out all our humanitarian reserves to do that. Yes. All of Europe should act together, and some European countries, like Germany, behaving well. We're halfway along the line. We could do better, but we're doing some good things. And I don't tell the government they're doing too many good things because I want to do more. But yes, we are doing some good things, but not enough, smaller scale. And I've also tried to make sure that our campaign for child refugees is not party political. We need the support across the board. It's not just a party political thing at all. And so I've tried to reach out and, you know, get support, in both houses of parliament across the political spectrum, and which is why I think public opinion is important, because in the end, it was at the beginning, it was public opinion that tipped the balance that made the government agree to my First Amendment. Public opinion was a powerful thing. So although I'd like Europe to act as a whole, in fact, the world to act as a whole, but certainly Europe to act as a whole, I think we can do better. I'm not giving up. There are two lots of children in Europe, the ones who have no family here, who were the subject of my amendment, and then there are the ones who've got family here. And there was more argument about them because they were covered by the Dublin Treaty, the EU Treaty. You're nodding your head so you know. And basically that says a child in one EU country can join, a refugee child can join a family in another EU country. So a Syrian boy in France could join an uncle in Birmingham. And we wanted that to continue after we left the EU, after that, and the government fought. First of all, we got it through and they pulled it. They changed the next bill and immigration bill and took it out again. And we thought they were behaving pretty shabbily. And I was forced to say, you know, if you're not being nasty, why look and sound as if you're being nasty? And I had meetings with ministers and so on. I met Theresa May way back and so on. Anyway, and we're going to keep going. You know, I've got a question down in Parliament this week about the refugees and so on. So we'll certainly keep going. And I think if we push the government enough, we'll get some people out. Look, if the numbers are small, but even if we get one child to safety, to a decent life, that is one victory for humanity. Of course, we'd like hundreds, far more. I've never said we should take them all, but I have said we should take our share, and we could do much better than we're doing. And when I think of what the situation was like at Moria Camp or people sleeping off under tarpaulins near Calais, terrible situation. We've got to do more.
I think you touched on a really good point, and it relates to public opinion. I found that the discussion around refugees have been in this country quite toxic on occasion, and maybe the media have had a role to play in that. With that in mind, why do you think that's the case? I believe you touched on the conflation between immigration and refugees and migration and people not understanding the difference. But also, when you see the level of toxicity that's been around refugees, do you feel as though there's been meaningful progress from, let's say, a time back in history, so we can look back to the Ugandan Asians, to now? Do you see there being meaningful progress?
Oh, you're asking a very difficult question. That's a really hard one. I mean, people should write books about it. First of all, can I go back a bit further than the Uganda Asians? Well, I'll talk about them as well, because I was involved with that too. In 1938-39, Britain took 10,000 kinder transport children, mainly from Germany, Austria, and Czechoslovakia. I was one, and that saved our lives. And although there was some argument in the British Parliament, on the whole, Britain took them. We then got the post-war period when there was a more relaxed attitude, and then came the Hungarian Revolution, and the Hungarians were welcomed in Western Europe, some in Britain. And when I complained about the hostile attitude to refugees to the Hungarian ambassador, I said, "We welcomed your people. Why can't you welcome refugees?" He said, "Oh, well, it's all different now." You know, and again, policy is we only want white Christians, we don't want anybody else, which is a pretty shabby attitude. So the attitudes have been hardening, and they hardened with the Uganda Asians, although when I was at local council in Westminster, a Tory-controlled council, we put some Ugandan Asian families top of our housing list because to give them housing and so on. And then came the Vietnamese boat people, and things got more difficult. Now, although I said it, I don't play party politics with child refugees. I try and get support all over. I do think when we had a government that said they want to keep the numbers down, that sent a signal. And when they want Britain to be an unwelcome place, whatever it is, that sends a signal. Because if people in Britain hear a government say the government doesn't want so many of these people, then the lesson is to say, well, we don't want to. Why should we be friendly to them? You know, and so, and I'm afraid the Brexit referendum built up a lot of hostility. I knocked on, probably as many doors as anybody you've met. You know, I was on the White City Estate, which, unlike its name, has actually got quite a lot of ethnic minority people on it, but still, and they were mainly for Remain. But where there were people for Leave, then immigration was pretty well the key issue in London. Take back control meant keep them out. And, I was talking to a woman, she's angry about Leave. And I said, why? She said, because of immigration. So I said, hang on a minute. I had to have a small procedure for one day in the local hospital in Hammersmith. And everybody who treated me, doctor, nurses, radiographer, they were all immigrants. Some were refugees, but all immigrants. Where would I be without them? And she said, significantly, it's not the ones that are here already that bother me. It's the ones that are going to come. And that's where Boris Johnson, with his saying that there were going to be 70 million Turks were going to enter Britain if we didn't leave the EU, and Farage with his thing, all his posters of all these people queuing up to get into Britain. I think that was a very shabby thing, and I'm afraid it poisoned the atmosphere. And although I argue that if we say to British people, child refugees are the most exceptional of all the exceptional categories, and somehow grudgingly there's an acceptance for not all, but some of child refugees, there's certainly more opposition now to people coming in than there was before. Not that the numbers have gone down, they may have gone down from Europe, but numbers from the rest of the world. It's all just plain politics by the government. And I'm afraid I find that very, very disappointing. And one wants people to speak out.
Amazing, thank you. So just to finish up, later this week is Holocaust Memorial Day. And the theme this year is Be the Light in the Darkness. And so you've mentioned hope being quite important to you, and the importance of having hope that things will get better. What at the moment, while we're obviously in the pandemic and things are looking dire in lots of ways, would you say is the kind of things that are bringing you hope and keep you hopeful for the work you're doing going forward?
Well, some of the things, of course, I mentioned. I think there is hope in that there are a fair number of people in Britain, in British public opinion, who understand the need for us to give safety to refugees. They understand that, and particularly for child refugees who are the most vulnerable. I get hope from the volunteers I mentioned earlier, who've given up a year or two of their lives to help the refugees. There's hope for the NGOs working here, who support for refugees, people Safe Passage and Help Refugees and Care for Calais. They do fantastic work. They've dedicated themselves to doing good work for refugees. So I believe there is hope. I also think the world we're in, we've got to work together. You mentioned, Rodney, you mentioned community. Well, community can work at local and wider, bigger, higher level, larger levels. When I was battling, I'm still battling, but in Parliament, when we could be there, you know, I had government ministers come up and say, keep on with your campaign. And I said, but wait, hang on a minute, you're a government minister, you're not supposed to say that to me. They said, keep on with your campaign. So I think there's a bit more support. There are some good people around who give us support, and one has to base one's hopes and beliefs in them. So the answer is, yeah, one has to hope, one has to believe in something, and one has to believe that Europe and the world can do better for refugees, and I believe we can do better, and I think we can push the government, and we won't get everything we want, but we can get a bit more than we get.
Great. So I think one of the key themes that Lord Dubs really touched on was the importance of hope, and that's something that means different things to people depending on their belief systems, but is something that regardless of religious belief or opinion, I think we're all united in knowing that we need, especially in something like the refugee crisis.
Yeah, I believe that our interview or conversation with Lord Dubs, just looking at that hope, I share Lord Dubs's sentiments that we need to leave our fellow human beings with that sense of hope. And I believe whilst the suffering of refugees can fill us with despair, their situation also offers us a chance to show that hope and kindness that you would expect when you see people suffering. And I've had the opportunity to read many stories about refugees, and I actually think refugees themselves epitomise hope. Hope is something that, as Christians, we're told to have and maintain. But I think one thing that's rarely said about hope is that it involves a lot of risk, a risk that must be run, particularly in our darkest days. And I actually love the fact that refugees refuse to let all that is bad in their current circumstances rob them of their faith to see the goodness of life. And not only the goodness of life, but that same goodness even in the worst situations. And I think as humans, our brains are normally programmed to be negative when we see things not as we like them to be. And for me, it's simple. Because we can find an abundance of reasons to forego our hope and justify the gloom that we have, it doesn't mean that we should. And when you look at refugees, you see their incredible resilience and sense of hope against all odds. And it's evident in their ability to acclimatise to a new environment and still be committed to serving the needs of others. And I think that hope is important that they show, and not necessarily what we even need to give them. But I think it's also incumbent on us also to give them that hope.
I think you're really right. And when Rodney and I were talking, when you and I were talking after speaking to Lord Dubs, something that you said, Rodney, was that so often we frame this conversation about refugees, about the impact on us. You know, people don't want us to lose out on resources or on school places or on jobs, you know, not that I'm saying that I believe that, but that's the kind of general language that's banded about. And it's so much about us. But if we're to look at the example of Jesus, it isn't about making decisions based on how things impact us, but on how they impact others, and how we can choose to love others and put them before ourselves. And like you said, as much as we can look to refugees and take hope from them, we also can see such clear examples of them putting others before themselves, you know, families taking such significant risks for the sake of their children or the sake of their loved ones. And so it's a real challenge to us as Christians to use this as a situation where we don't put our own interests first, but instead choose to put the interests of others before ourselves.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I also found interesting Lord Dubs being a humanist. To be honest, I didn't know what a humanist was before the interview. Meg actually had to tell me because I had no clue. After doing a bit of research, I found it quite interesting, the point Lord Dubs made. And he made a point along the lines of how he believes that you can treat people as Christ stated we should treat people in the Bible without necessarily believing in Christ himself. And it is something that Meg and I both agree with. I think we've had previous conversations where we've spoken about how Christians in politics have a set of beliefs, but these are beliefs that can be shared by people not necessarily of the faith. And I think we see that in the humanist way of thinking regarding refugees. If we look at a number of countries who have accepted a great number of refugees that have potentially compromised a substantial proportion of their population, those countries have been able to understand that despite there being a potential difference in religion or culture, refugees simply what their citizens have already, which is that safety and that home and that opportunity to give back to a society. And I think it is in those moments we really understand the true depths of hospitality. And at a time when many nations could easily turn their back on refugees, some countries have taken that responsibility on themselves to have a more better understanding, I would say, that the refugee crisis isn't just solely a Middle Eastern problem or this problem or that problem, but it's a global one, a human one. And I think it is really looking at the humanness of the individual, because hospitality is really grounded in that belief that it could be any of us. We could be those refugees seeking haven elsewhere, and the reality is that no group or nation is immune from that reality.
And I think there's also something really great in what Lord Dubs was saying that you've touched on there, Rodney, about unity. If we are to actually make any serious legway on serious, really, well, life and death issues like the refugee crisis, we need to be willing to work with others. Sometimes I think we're good at being hospitable or being welcoming to people when it kind of serves us. But to let ourselves, in terms of this issue, almost be served by others, to work with others and see our shared humanity as the humanists would. Because the refugee crisis, like you said, as much as it could be anyone, it also affects such a vast variety of people groups and countries. If we are to really to achieve anything, then we need to have unity in our hospitality. Otherwise, it's likely to be pretty empty.
Almighty, all-loving, all-merciful God, whose own son was a child refugee in Egypt, having fled his home with his family for fear of his life. We pray now for the 26 million refugees around the world today, half of whom are kids, who have fled their homes to escape war or persecution. Lord, the statistics are unfathomable. And the ever-worsening context is unthinkable, and we know your heart breaks for each and every one of them in their suffering. So would you bring them comfort? Would you bring them peace? Would you give them shelter? Would you give them food and water? Would you give them companionship? Would you give them moments of joy? And would you give them tangible reasons for hope? For as Alf said, it is hard to survive without hope. Lord Jesus, we believe you are the hope of the world. And as the body of Christ, may we embody that hope and become light in this world so full of darkness, the darkness to which we know we have contributed. And Lord, we are sorry for our part in this problem. We are sorry for our apathy and disinterest. We are sorry for the moments in which we have turned a blind eye to the heresy of toxic nationalism that prioritizes our self-interests over the interests of others, especially those who are powerless, marginalized, vulnerable, and suffering. Would you forgive us, restore us, and transform us into a nation that exemplifies compassion and seeks the common good, understanding that while we can't solve the whole world's problems, we want to play our part in welcoming your kingdom, which is welcoming to all. Lord, our hearts break at the question, where was God in the Holocaust? It's a question that cries of both personal pain and perfectly understandable objective bewilderment. We are sorry for the answers we give to these questions that bypass lament and disguise our own doubts. We are sorry too for distancing ourselves from today's atrocities, preferring to live in ignorant bliss. Lord, I want to say, when future generations ask, where was God in Moria? Where was God in the Uyghur internment camps in China? Where was God in the Mediterranean and the English Channel waters? I want to be able to say, he was there. And here is how I know that to be true. I witnessed him sitting beside those who were grieving, those who were suffering. I witnessed him crying out to the oppressors and traffickers. I witnessed him sending rescue boats out to the sea. I witnessed him driving compassionate immigration bills in Parliament. I witnessed him organising community sponsorship programmes to welcome refugees in local communities. I witnessed him working in and through his people the world over to express his unconditional love, his unparalleled mercy, and his amazing grace to those most desperately in need. Lord, have mercy. Finally, Lord, I want to thank you for Alf, for all he has done and continues to do to make this country a more welcoming place for refugees. I want to thank you too for Nicholas Winton, the man who rescued Alf when he arranged the transfer of 669 child refugees to the UK towards the end of the Second World War. Lord, I thank you for all those who, in their vein, continue to organise and fight to welcome strangers. Or as the writer of Hebrews puts it, to welcome angels without knowing it. Or as you put it in the book of Matthew, to welcome none other than your very self into this country we call home. May it be home for so many more. And may we do everything we can to make that possible. Amen.
Amazing. Thanks so much for listening, guys. Make sure you follow us on social media at Instagram at Faith in Politics Podcast.
And on Twitter at FIP_podcast.
See you next time.
Bye.